There can be bad language and adult concepts in this program. So please watch out for little ears if you've got your podcast playing and pop on some headphones. That way no one can get offended but you. Rights for Women would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which this podcast is recorded throughout Australia. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded and pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we celebrate women writers, support women's rights and talk all things women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author. I'm founder of Listen Up Podcasting, where we make podcasts for a positive world. Check me out at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or find me on Facebook.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of 5 novels, 4 traditionally published and 1 indie release. I'm a writing teacher and a podcaster. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is available now at all online retailers and at pamelacook.com.au.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe wherever you get your pods. Hey there, listeners, this is Kel, just quickly introducing this episode of The Convo Couch today. This conversation with Nicole Hurley-Moore actually started life as a book launch episode, where we were going to talk about her new book, The McAllister Legacy. But it turned into an inspiring conversation about how serious life matters kicked Nicole right up the butt and made her take control of her writing career, made her reach for that dream. A conversation we thought deserved a lot more depth. So we went for it, and this is the result.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nicole Hurley-Moore, and my latest book, The McAllister Legacy, has just been released from Allen & Unwin. And so today I'm going to read you a really short little extract from it. The setup of the story is that my main character, Berry, has just returned to her childhood home that she hasn't been back to in over 11 years. So the house has been sitting vacant, and this is her first impression as she walks through it. The rain was getting heavier, dimming the light that there was. The room seemed to close in on her a little, and again she wondered if she should have put off the trip until Jess or her brother Tom had been able to come. She walked over to the light switch and flicked it. Still nothing. Berry felt she wasn't entirely sure, maybe a little skittish, a little melancholy, a little uneasy. The rain was beginning to drum on the old iron roof, and she had a bit of light. If she had had a bit of light and a cheery fire, it might have been comforting. But instead, she had a silent and chilly house that only served to give bad memories the power to overwhelm the good. Berry quickly walked to the back door and locked it. She paused for a second as the silence of the house enveloped her. She was all of a sudden aware of the sound of her breath, sucking in and blowing out against the backdrop of the rain. The air was still, as if she was still holding her breath, and as the moments passed, the more constricted her lungs began to feel, as ever-growing panic began to coil within her. She looked down the darkened hallway and took in a gulp of air, reminding herself that there was nothing to be afraid of. But with each passing second, more rattled she became. She turned back to the door and double-checked that it was locked, and as she did, a shiver ran down Berry's spine. She could almost hear her mother faintly calling her name. She knew that the voice came from memory rather than reality, but as she stood in the silent, shadowed house, both the worlds seemed to merge. "It's just in my head. It's just in my head," Berry muttered. She turned around and headed to the front door, keeping her eyes straight ahead, not daring to glance over her shoulder. To hell with this. She was going to stay at the B&B. She would come back when she had sunlight and electricity to frighten away the ghosts.
That was really engaging. I just found myself lost in that for a minute when you were reading. Tell us more about this particular book and the characters within it.
Well, The McAllister Legacy starts with a terrible, terrible tragedy that pulls a family, well, it destroys most of a family, leaving the children orphaned. And so the book actually then doesn't start until the eldest child, Berry, comes back to sell the old family farm as an adult. She's been told what happened to her family, and everybody in town knows about it, of course, because a huge tragedy in a small town is remembered forever. And, and it's her trying to navigate the, well, I'm just here, I'm closing up the house, I'm selling it, and getting, by doing that, you know, shutting the book on the past and moving back to Melbourne where her brother and sister and uncle are. But as she spends more time in Harlington, more questions arise, and she starts to believe that maybe there's something more to what happened to her family than she first thought.
This is not your first book.
No, it's not.
So how many books have you written? Because you've written a few before this one.
Yeah, this is number six with Alan and Unwin. So that's six rural suspense books. But I've written maybe three or four other medieval-inspired fantasy fairy tales and quite a few little novellas. So, yeah.
So have you always wanted to write? Was this something that was always in you?
I didn't really start thinking about it until I was a teenager, but yes, I suppose it was always in the back of my mind. I did try earlier on and got so discouraged I gave up.
So, what happened? What discouraged you to that point?
Oh, well, it was a long, long time ago. And I thought, no, I'm going to try and write. And I started writing some historical sort of Mills and Boone, I suppose, type, you know, that sort of historical type book. And I sent it off. And, of course, it got rejected because, let's face it, 9 times out of 10, your first manuscript does.
It's your practice.
It's your practice. I've got a few practice things that will never see the light of day from then on. But because I didn't, it was, as I said, it was a long time ago, and because I didn't really know about other connections like the Australian RWA and other writers' groups and everything, I got the rejection. I just thought, oh, well, I suck. So I obviously
Nicole.
Yeah, like I have no business even trying to write, so I stopped, which was really stupid. But, yeah.
How long did you put your dream aside?
Oh, until the kids were probably late teenagers. Wow. And I'd started, I won years and years ago when my eldest, and she's like 27 now, I won a Woman's Day competition, and I got shuffled over to England to meet one of the editors of Mills and Boone. But then, yeah, things just happened and it just didn't work out. So I didn't start writing until I suppose she was probably 16.
And what was the impetus? What started you writing again? What got it all?
I started writing again because I thought, no, this is something I really want to do. And so, you know, I mucked around with things, and about 9 years ago, I suppose, maybe 8 years ago, I thought, it was 8 years ago, 2012. Yeah, I decided that if I was ever going to do it, I should give it a shot. And then I got really, really sick, and I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I really have to do it now, you know, because, you know. But everything turned out all right, and that's when I started really concentrating on writing.
So was it like you had one of those moments that just made you recognise, hey, the time is now?
Yeah, I got breast cancer, and I thought, right, okay.
Wow.
You know, and it sort of was the – It was a really weird thing. I thought, if I'm going to do it, this is the time. And it was really helpful because I know it sounds stupid, but I had the writing to distract me from the cancer. Does
amazing. 100%. Wow. Yeah. So the breast cancer was what became the impetus to unlock your writing and make you just go, who cares? Who cares? I've just got to do it. And
that's
at
right.
the same time, by doing that, you allowed yourself a way to get through such a challenging journey. Oh, my gosh, I'm getting all teary. That's Nicole, yeah. What a story. Wow, so, thank you for sharing that.
That's okay. But, yeah, I mean, so I suppose the moral is don't give up like I did when I was younger, because that's just silly. And just, you know, go for it, because you never know where it'll lead. I mean, when I first got published, it was with a very small American imprint, you know, which has since gone belly up, which is a shame. But you know, it was a stepping stone. And then I had a book with Escape, just one historical novel. And again, you know, I learned an awful lot from them, and I'm really grateful to them. And then by a fluke, I ended up at Helen and Unwin. We could say fluke, or you could say it was, I don't know, destiny. I don't know.
You have to tell us that story now. My goodness. How did destiny or a fluke land you with Helen and Unwin?
So as you know, I was writing like medieval fairy tales, which I love, still do, right? And then all of a sudden, one day I got this idea of these two guys talking, brothers, fighting over a woman, and one saying, well, she's never going to get over me because I'm the one that broke her heart. Mm. And the other brother says, yeah, well, I'm the one that put it back together.
Oh,
and I thought,
nice.
Wow. And I thought, this isn't medieval.
I'm genre hopping here.
So I thought, oh, okay, well, that was cute, but, you know. But I couldn't stop thinking about it. And so then I sat down, and all of a sudden I had sort of like three scenes, and I'm thinking, oh, you know. And I decided, no, I'm gonna write it. I don't write contemporary stories, but I'm gonna write it because, you know, it won't leave me alone. So I did, and it didn't take me very long. I was very surprised. And then I finished it, and I thought, well, what am I going to do with it now? I have this rural story. I thought, oh, I'll go on Facebook and see if there's any, you know, like rural fiction writers groups.
Yeah.
And I found one, and at the top there was a pinned post from one of the editors of Helen and Unwin saying, has anybody got any rural stories? And I went, oh, okay. So I sent it to her, and that's it.
Wow. There you go. Just fated. Bam.
Fated.
I'm interested. You said that it happened quickly and you were surprised by that. So how long did it take to write, and how long did it normally take you to write a book?
Okay, so normally it takes me about 6 months, normally. McKellen's Run took me about 3 months. Mm. Yeah, and my latest book, because there was last year wasn't great. it took me about a year and a half to write. So,
And I'm imagining this year for millions of people around the world is not going to be one of those great ones. For some people, lots is happening. For others, it's a standstill. Creativity as well, I think, is so dependent upon what's happening within the rest of your world.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, last year, as I said, wasn't a great year for me and mine. Mm. And I get bombarded with, as most writers do, I'm assuming, story, plot lines, ideas all the time. And of course, some are going to fly and some aren't, but you know, I write them all down. But last year, I didn't have any. Not one.
Really?
Not one.
How did that make you feel? Like, was that a scary thing for you, or were you glad to have the space because there were other things happening in your world?
No, terrified. Terrified because it had never, ever happened to me before.
Wow.
Because usually I have, I keep notebooks and diaries and things like that, which are just filled with ideas. And so you know, I think, oh, well, I can work on that. And, yeah, that idea's okay, but, yeah, no, I'm not really feeling it. So it just gets left. But, yeah, not to have any. I'm sort of thinking, oh, gosh. But this year it's okay. I've thought of lots. So obviously we're back in the saddle.
So do you feel like there was an alignment that occurred with the things in your life starting to find some kind of balance and you being able to connect back with your creative self again?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, things went topsy-turvy last year, so I suppose by the end of it things were starting to right themselves. I managed to finish the book. And, yeah, from then on things have been falling back into place, I suppose.
So you were writing the book again while things were topsy-turvy, and I'm not going to pry too deeply into what was happening in your life. It's up to you what you'd like to talk about. But what I'm interested to know is that it sounds like writing the book, because you were writing while you were going through this, was that a challenge for you to do this time, whereas before it seemed like it was more a healing part of your journey?
I was actually surprised, to tell you the truth, because for the second time I got cancer. But this time it wasn't as bad, right? It's okay, everything's fine. But, you know, there's those months that go by and you're not 100% sure and you think, oh, gosh, here we go again, and all of the horrible stuff that comes with, you know, all the chemos and things like that. But that didn't happen this time. But at one point I thought it was going to. And so where the first time I focused on the writing to get me through it and keep my mind off it. So the writing this time was really difficult, and I couldn't actually think of the words to continue on. And I was just stuck. And, yeah, so, I mean, the book, the story, I liked the story, but I found it like, even though I liked it, I'd sit down and I'd go, yeah, but I don't know what to say. And so it went on for several months like that.
It's so funny. You were saying earlier, and I just wanted to say, A, I'm really sorry that you've had to go through all this. It's awful. And, you know, I'm sorry that anyone has to go through it. But I also really admire the way you talk about it with such honesty. It's obviously still really hard for you, and I really am grateful. You were saying that you felt this time around it wasn't as bad and you didn't have to go through all of those things, but almost emotionally it seems like it was more crippling for you. And I'm wondering if that's because this time around you knew what you were in for if it did go down that path, and that knowledge of itself was such a weight for you to carry, and then being in that limbo as you didn't know whether you were about to step into that again or not, I can imagine that would have been such a stuck feeling for you. Do you think that that weight is what was contributing to also then blocking you creatively?
I think so, because the last thing I wanted to do was go down that path again. It really was. But, you know, there's that old saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So. You know, you just keep moving forward, and that's all you can do.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's really weird right through it. You know, my grandmother was a very formed woman, and she always used to say, usually at really inappropriate times, but, you know, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Get up, get on with it, get going. Yeah. And, you know, that was the voice I had in my head, and so that's what you had. But, yeah, I think that was part of it. It was that, and I just, as I said, there was no words coming, no stories coming. It was,
I'm assuming that the unlocking of your creativity then coincided with you finding out that you were going to be okay and that you didn't have to go down that path. So it freed you. That knowledge freed you.
It did.
Wow.
And it took a little while to get things moving again, but, yeah, it did, yeah.
And how are you feeling? So all of that happened and then we went into COVID-19. May I ask how that made you feel? Because, of course, you're also incredibly vulnerable.
Well, yeah, but you see, I'm a really big introvert, so staying at home such a big thing for me.
It's like, yeah, I got this.
It's my time to shine.
I know lots of writers who are feeling that way.
So, I mean, look, the other thing too is that my family is still at home with me, so I haven't been forced into total isolation, if you know what I mean. So I can understand where it's absolutely terrible for other people out there that are by themselves or can't see their kids or can't see their grandkids. It'd be awful. But, yeah, as I said, I'm lucky that way.
Mm. And what about your family? What was their response to watching you pursue your dreams and then achieve it time after time after time while you're going through this incredibly challenging time together?
Well, they've always been really supportive. My husband's always supported my writing. Even way back when I was going, no, I can't, I suck. And he goes, oh, no, keep going, you know. So he's always been really supportive, and so have the kids. So, yeah, I'm lucky that way.
I'd love to hear then about the publishing process and going down the path. So first you won the competition.
All those years ago.
And you went through two different publishers, to one, the one that's gone out of business, and then you went with, you got published with Escape, and then you went to Allen & Unwin. Is that right?
I did. That's right.
So you've worked across a number of different publishers, editors, sort of processes. How has that been? Give us some insight into what you've learned.
Well, it's been really, really interesting. And as a first writer, when you get your sort of, you know, your first contract and that, you never quite know what to expect. Mm-hmm. And you really don't, well, at least I didn't, because you know, I was pretty stupid in these ways. I didn't know what was going to happen. So, you know, with the editing and everything, I always found that I find editing really challenging. I love it, as in I know it's there to make my book the very best it can be, but it always makes me cry.
Do you take it very personally?
No, it's not so much that. It's more that I sometimes get overwhelmed and I sort of think, oh, how am I going to do it? And then I tend to panic because I am a panic bunny, so, you know, but it all ends up well.
And is that more with the structural edits, I'm thinking, then when they say, you know, maybe if we move this over here, or we need to draw more out of this, or where you have to then go and reimagine the book? Is that where you get that fear? Yeah.
I do get a little, it's with the structural edits. And I mean, sometimes I have to do a lot, sometimes I don't have to do much, but I always seem to manage to get overwhelmed with it. Either way. But it's always for the best. Ellen and Unwin, they're lovely. They're so lovely. And their edits are so thorough, which makes me cry. but no, they're marvellous. They really are.
What was it like to launch your first book out into the world? This is the first time you've done it. This is your dream come true. Little publisher, but still a book out in the world. You know, what was it like and what did you do?
Like, it was a stepping stone, but I also thought at the time that, you know, this was a dream. I mean, we always dream. We always look towards the future. And as we do, our dreams change. I mean, before I was published, my biggest dream was to get published. And then when you're published, your next dream is, well, maybe to get, you know, a bigger publisher or you know, write a series of books or whatever. So, yeah, things change. But when that first happened, I was very happy.
And when you did your first big launch with Allen and Unwin, how was that? And what were the distinct differences there?
I remember walking into the one of the shopping malls up around here, and there was a huge big poster of McKellen's Run on the wall, and I'm just like, it's my book. And also seeing your book on the shelf for the first time, that never gets old.
Mm. And launching your book now in COVID-19, how has that been different for you?
A little bit of a challenge. I mean, I've been doing the last few books, I've been doing like library tours and going out and talking to readers, and which has been really lovely. And of course, this year there's no sort of face to face. So yes, everything's been online, and which is nice, but I have to admit, I miss not talking to the readers.
It's funny, I was about to say, but as you already mentioned, you're more of an introvert and the whole being at home isn't such a bad thing for you, and you get a bit nervous. So maybe this way of launching a book might be more comfortable, but I love that you've worked out already that you do miss that personal interaction.
And I sort of don't get that nervous when I go to the library. I get a bit nervous, but not as nervous.
Really? That's really interesting. Yeah. I wonder why. Why would that be?
I don't know. I'm thinking that the people are there that have come to see you, come to talk about your book, have an interest. So, I mean, it's not like trying to convert a room full of people that don't want to be there.
That's true. And at a library, where's a safer place for a writer to be, really?
Exactly.
Yeah. I wonder if that has something to do with it as well. You're going into a space where writing and writers are revered. So, hey.
And I used to work in libraries a long time ago. So,
really?
Feel my way around.
You can see the stepping stones leading you in this direction. I'm interested to know, through all of this writing and paralleled with these incredible personal challenges at the same time, after having had years of putting a dream aside and then suddenly having it realized in its fullest possible extent, what are the key takeaways, the key lessons that you've learnt in all of this? Putting all of that together, what are the things that you identify as being the crucial lessons?
Learn to believe in yourself, which is something that I, even to this day, have trouble with. But yes, that's the crux of it. There's those the voices in your head that always say, yeah, you can't do this, you've got no right. Or who wants to read one of your stories? And that can be crippling. It's that whole self-doubt. Also, never, ever, ever compare yourself to another writer, because that just ends in tears. So many stories of people getting so upset because they feel like they're stuck and their friends are flying high, but, you know, there's no point.
Your journey, it's got nothing to do with anybody else.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. That you don't have to pull people down for you to succeed. So that's another one.
Where did that one come from? Because I can't imagine from talking to you here that you would be someone who would look to pull others down.
No, I'm usually on the receiving end.
Okay, so you felt that way, that others have tried to pull you down so they could succeed.
Yeah. So, and I mean, you know, again, it's a useless thing, because we're all on our own journey and we'll all get to where we're meant to be as long as we try our best and focus on it, really.
So is that going back to that lesson of self-worth and self-belief again?
I mean, personally, I've had a couple of things said to me, and I thought, well, you know, if that had been said to me when I was putting out my very first book, I probably wouldn't have kept writing.
I've very much been pondering, just looking around at the world generally, the idea that I think we need to be more responsible, very much so, with the energy we project into the world and put onto people, because we don't need to project things with such negativity at times when we do. I think just generally within our interactions with each other every day. I was having a talk with someone and they weren't able to make an appointment and I didn't care, and they were you know, oh, it's so nice not to have someone, you know, hassle me. I was scared you're going to be upset. It's like, what's the point of me doing that? What I get really upset with you. It's out of my control. It's out of your control. You then what? You get stressed and upset and you then put that on another human being because you're dumping your stress that I've dumped on you onto someone else. Whereas if I took responsibility for the way I react to a change in circumstances and choose to react with compassion and kindness and understanding, all of a sudden, your whole energy changes into a more positive way and you deal with others in a positive way. And that's taking responsibility for the energy of what we're putting into the world, I think is so important, and we're just not conscious enough of it.
That's right. And I think it's, as I said, particularly with online and you know, social medias and things, it's very easy for people to fall into, well, you know, I'm going to say what I'm going to say, you know, because I can. And you think, well, yeah, but why? Why are you doing that?
Exactly. Why? Why do you need to? And what's it feeding you? But what's it also taking away from someone else? And is it okay to give yourself something by having to take it away from another? The other side of that is, I heard you mention the words before. You said people, you know, in this online environment, they get on the keyboard and they can be brave. And I actually, when I have this conversation with you, I don't think so. I think they can be incredibly cowardly, and that keyboard enables them, that screen, that lack of one-on-one contact enables that cowardice, because you don't have to be accountable for the reaction and the impact of when those words land on that other human being. I think being brave is saying what you want in a way that doesn't have to take from another.
I can't see why we have to be this way. And of course, not everybody is, but there is a, you know, small portion of people that will be like this and can really, I think, when it comes to writing, damage other writers.
100%. Self-esteem is so fragile and it's so unnecessary to trample on it when you do have the choice to be able to be a part of its growth, pretty much. Yeah, I 100% agree. And you know what? I think you're right. No, I think it is a problem. I think if we look outside our windows and look at our news feeds and we have a look at how the world's interacting with each other, no, it's a problem that we need to really look at about our individual responsibility for how we're dealing with others. Definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, got a bit philosophical there, Nicole. Got a bit deep.
So maybe we should go back to cats and dogs.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about, now that you're unlocked, now that you're inspired and all those ideas are flowing, where are you heading next with your writing? Are you going to stick with writing real romance, or are you looking in other directions now?
Well, real romance, I love it. I'm sort of, it's still real romance, but I'm sort of moving a little bit into the suspense as well. And I love it, and it's part of me. But, yeah, I've got, like, medieval's part of me too, and, well, historical anyway. So, yes, I've got a few ideas coming. I've got another rural that I've just started working on, but I also wanted to work on a contemporary story with dual timelines and a diverse characters. So I'm working on that too.
Interesting. And will they also be with Alan and Unwin, or will you need to look for other publishers if you change direction?
I'm not sure. So I'll write it and I'll find out, I suppose.
The next big adventure.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not going to stop writing rural because I really love it. It's just, you know, it's those things that you think of a story and then that story becomes part of you and you want to get the story out. At least that's what happens to me. And sometimes that will be a rural and sometimes it'll be something else. So, yeah.
What is your process when you write? Are you a pantser? Do you write every day when you're in the process? Is it, how do you go about it?
Okay, so when I get the idea, I sit down and I do what I call a story run, which is I suppose it's a bit like a synopsis, but it's about three pages from beginning to end, and I might not even have character names or anything like that. I just get the basic story out. And from there I sit down and I plot to every scene, every chapter. There's wiggle room and sometimes I go off script, but, yeah, no, I plot out everything right to the end.
Wow.
Because I need a map to follow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How long does it take you to plot?
Not long. A couple days. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So you're plotting out every scene of every chapter. So you plot the whole book.
Yeah, plot the whole book.
Incredible. Yeah. That's what Kate Forsyth does.
Well, does she?
Yeah, and so does Anita Heiss. They create like a map, like a blueprint, like you're doing. So you are absolutely a plotter.
I'm a plotter. Absolutely. And as I said, you know, there's a bit of wiggle room, but that's basically where it goes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you plotted it all out, and then do you do it chronologically? Do you get inspired by the scene? How does it go?
I usually write chronologically unless I get stuck. And then I'll go off and play with another scene and come back to it and keep going.
Okay, so that's how you deal with a block, is you go work on something else. Do you revise your work as you write once you start writing, or do you just go for it and then and don't look at it until the first draft is done?
No, I revise as I go. So, like, I'll write a sentence, look at it, write it better. Oh. Write it better again and then move on. And then, of course, you know, I'll revise it when I go through it once it's finished. But, yeah I sort of do that. So,
does that make copy edits really tight? Like you don't have a lot of copy edits?
Well, they're not bad. Mm. They're not bad because I go through it and then I give it to my husband, who doesn't like romance but reads my books.
So. I love that. That's true support.
Support.
Yes. Okay, and then it's off to the publisher and you get your run of structural and copy edits. So how long between that first draft, that first 6 months, and then hitting the shelves?
Probably 5 or 6 months. The problem is I get stuck, you know, making up my story Bibles and things like that. Waste time that way.
Oh, so tell me about your story Bible.
Oh, I have one for every book, and you know, it's like what the characters look like, what are their emotional wounds, what are they trying to achieve, and then you know, inspiration for what they look like and places and things like that.
So is that what else? A computer file, or is that in like a notebook or something?
Oh, I am so old school. I really am. It's all in notebooks for individual books. I've got like a notebook each, and for a series I use like planners.
Wow. I just want to ask, is there anything about the book that you would like listeners to know about now, and where can they go off and get it?
Well, you can get it from the bookstore and from places like W, and online from Amazon and Booktopia. And even Book Depository, I think, and Angus and Robinson. Yeah.
So it is available in ebook and on audiobook, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the audio, it's on Audible at the moment, but the audiobook is coming out on the 1st of September, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. Where can readers find you?
Oh, well, I have an author Facebook page, which is Nicole Hurley-Moore Author, I think. And a website, which is www.nicolehurleymoore.com, which is pretty easy.
And you can find all of Nicole's books on that website. So it's a fantastic spot to be able to just get everything all at once. That's the rural romance, the historical romance, and also the medieval stories and fairy tales as well. They're all on that website. Before we head off, though, I'd really love to ask you who you're reading and if you can recommend another female Australian author that people should go out and grab and read.
Okay, so Lisa Ireland's book, is it The Secret Life of Shirley?
I know the one you're talking about, and we spoke to Lisa. Yes, but yeah. I've forgotten. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Lisa, I love you.
Sorry, Lisa.
I loved it. So, yes, I just finished reading that.
Excellent. Go back in the feed. Lisa Ireland's in the feed and have a listen. There you go. Good luck with this, with the release of this book. Good luck with the release of the next book and the one after that. I'm so happy to hear that you're back on your writing path again and that the ideas are flowing for you freely. It's been wonderful chatting with you today, Nicole. Thank you.
It's been lovely chatting with you too. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Rights for Women podcast. If you enjoyed listening, we would really appreciate it if you could head over to wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating or review so that other people can find us too. If you want to hear more brilliant conversations with great writers, you can head to our website, www.rightsforwomen.com, where you can catch all the episodes from the Convo Couch and the Anatomy of a Novel series, as well as the book launch, a season of episodes created to help authors launch their books in isolation.
And while you are there, why don't you check out our Patreon page? Patreon is how people can support the artists making the work they love. So if you love Rights for Women and want to support us in supporting other authors, become a Patreon subscriber and get some cool little bonuses while you're at it. To everyone who is already a subscriber, we appreciate your passion for our project and thank you very much. You can always find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. Thank you for staying home and supporting our authors. This podcast episode was produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.